Hello, welcome to another episode of Pining for Pixels. I'm your host, Red Rooster, and on today's show, we're going to do another retroactive Game of the Year award in our valiant attempt to catch up to the modern day. So today we'll be starting with the year 2003 and see how far we can get. All right, so before we get into that, let's talk about some of the news. So first off the top, a little bit of housekeeping. I just wanted to say, up to this point, my email has been the primary place that you can reach me, and that is redroostersgamingcoop@gmail.com. However, I just wanted to point out that I have finally went through with using my X/Twitter account, so I'm trying to be a little more active on X now. So please go and follow me on X. It is at redroostergc, so that's redroostergc. And that is my X handle, and I've been trying to post stuff, repost some stuff, and yeah, this is going to be also where I announce when my episodes go live, and I'd love to have people interacting with me on there. So please follow me, and you can also send me any DMs or anything like that. Be great. Okay, so with that out of the way, let's move on to the news. What's been going on in the past little bit? Well, for one thing, Destiny 2, they have their next expansion, The Final Shape, coming up, which, to be honest, I don't 100% know. I think it may be, not only is it The Final Shape, but I think it's going to be probably the final expansion for Destiny. But they have announced its new release date. So it was originally set for, I think, February originally, and there was a lot of Bungie has faced a lot of backlash that their most recent one, Lightfall, was not very warmly received by fans, and there's been a couple of little blunders here and there through Bungie, and news came out just a little bit ago that they had lost a lot of revenue, and things were not going well for the team there. They had some layoffs, unfortunately, which is always terrible to hear. But they've come back saying, hey, we're going to really double down and make The Final Shape something awesome. And there was a lot of rumors that it would be pushed to summer, although they kept saying, no, that's not the case. So they have come out and now provided an updated release date saying that it is now going to be coming out on June the 4th. So technically not summer. I don't believe summer officially begins until late June, but, or is it late May? No, I think it's late June. So either way, it's not, not quite as late as some thought, but either way, June, it got pushed back quite a bit. So we'll see what happens with it. Now, I've always liked Bungie from the past. Obviously they're heritage with Halo. I liked the first Destiny for a little bit, and Destiny 2 I liked for a little bit as well, but I was never really hardcore into the Destiny series, as they are those live service games, and I mean it's really kind of the mold for a successful live service game, as they've been very successful. But it's, I don't know, to be honest, I think when Destiny 2 started removing content, because they originally had the game where you would play like the original campaign, then each of the expansions would have continuations to the story and obviously all the live service stuff. But there was a lot of content coming out as they released content packs and expansions. So they eventually started removing some content from the game. So now if you want to log in and play vanilla Destiny 2, like the original stuff, to get caught up with the story, there's no way to actually play that stuff. You can only play the stuff that they currently have out, and they've had a ton of different. Now I don't really know what's going on with the lore, and I just feel like I'm so disconnected from it. So for me, I mean, it's fun though. The gameplay still feels good, and it is fun in that way. So from a gameplay perspective, it's fun. But I always like to kind of get into the lore a little bit, and I guess because I was previously into the lore, now going back to revisit Destiny, I feel like so disconnected from it, and I don't know, it's just harder for me to get into it, but I don't know, maybe it would be awesome if I really delve deep, I don't know, but they are promising great things for Destiny 2, so we'll see how that all plays out. But yeah, that's what's going on with them. Hopefully they see success, because it's too bad that they've had to see all those layoffs recently, but we'll see what the future holds. Now, this past weekend, of course, was Thanksgiving weekend in the United States. So happy Thanksgiving to any American listeners out there. I hope you had a great holiday and a great Thanksgiving weekend. But of course, as we all know, when a Thanksgiving weekend rolls around in the U.S., so does Black Friday, the big time sales event. So even here in Canada, we have, you know, I remember a long time ago, Black Friday was never really a thing here. We would sometimes see some residual sales simply because American companies would have sales in effect that would translate up here as well, but not always. And it used to be you would hear about it, but we wouldn't really have anything. In Canada, we would have Boxing Day after Christmas. That was our really big sales day. But in recent years, Black Friday's really caught on here. And although our Thanksgiving is in October, we do have the American Black Friday, and all the companies here participate in it as well. So really the Black Friday stuff had been going on for about a week prior to, but the real, real big Black Friday stuff went on Thursday and Friday of this past week. And, you know, I remember in the past, a long time ago, places like GameStop or EB Games would have pretty great sales. And this is like, you know, back in the PS4, PS3, in prior days, they would have really, really good sales. So it would be to the point where I knew if I wanted to get an Ubisoft title or an EA Sports game, I knew I could just hold off until Black Friday, because you knew that the discounts would be pretty extensive there. But I would say in the past couple of years, they haven't been really that good or that generous. So I kind of thought that maybe those days were behind us, but this year felt like a return to that kind of form, because I thought that there was a lot more, just in terms of video game sales, a lot more titles that were getting discounts that were in line with what they used to be. So pretty big cuts. Even something like UFC 5, which is the UFC fighting video game that EA has just recently put out, got a pretty big discount considering it just came out. And all the predictable sports stuff got pretty good discounts, as well as a whole bunch of other games. Like, a lot of games got pretty sizable cuts. I guess now that we're a few years into the current console cycle with Xbox Series X and PS5, that they feel a little more confident in doing that. I'm assuming, and given that all those previous lockdowns and stuff are no longer happening, you know, we are kind of back to normal with that stuff. So it was cool to see. I mean, I had already bought most of the stuff that I was interested in, so I didn't really pick anything up myself, but I did see that there was a lot of pretty good deals out there. Kind of made me think, some of these titles I wish I would have waited for. I remember Immortals of Avium I wanted to pick up. So on the one hand, I remember thinking at the time, this might go on sale at Black Friday, maybe I should wait, but that was back in the summer. But then it looked pretty good, and I was like, I'm just going to give it a shot. So on the one hand, I wish I could have saved the money on it. However, I'm glad I bought it when I did, because I know that studio really struggled, and I think they eventually did get shuttered by EA because they weren't successful. But, you know, I wanted to support them because I know it's more important to buy the thing at the time if you really want to support them, to show them, you know, a measure of success that way. So anyway, hopefully you out there have had some success and managed to pick up a stack of games at pretty decent prices, because they're pretty good. But either way, keep an eye open, because these things often last throughout the holiday season, and they may come back again as well for Boxing Day. So lots of good stuff out there for right now. But yeah, one thing of interest, though, that happened as well in relation to Black Friday is with Assassin's Creed. Not necessarily specifically about a sale, but kind of. So if you happen to be playing any of the previous Assassin's Creed titles, like maybe Assassin's Creed Odyssey, Origins, Valhalla even, I don't know. But I had heard, and I saw a video, that there was some players were finding that when they were pausing their game or in the middle of playing their Assassin's Creed game, like checking the map screen, when they did that, they suddenly got shown an ad for Assassin's Creed Mirage, the newest one, just saying, hey, on Black Friday, this game has this discount. Buy now. And then it returned them to their game. So a lot of people reached out to Ubisoft saying, what the heck? I just got this commercial flashed on my screen in the middle of my game. Or at least when I like pause my game or check the map screen, it flashed this commercial for me. I saw some video of it, and it was definitely quite garish looking that happened. So Ubisoft has come in and said, oh, you know, that was just an accident. We don't know how this happened. Ooh, whoops. But to me, I do believe that this was no accident. They were probably experimenting to see how far they could push it, because it very much, when you watch the video, very much looks like they were just kind of seeing what they could get away with, right? Because if you're already playing Assassin's Creed, that must mean you're interested in the franchise, and this, what better way of possibly squeezing in a couple sales by flashing some quick ads. I mean, I don't really mind too much if that's the case, if it were a free-to-play game. But the thing is, these people have purchased their copy of Assassin's Creed, and having that ad flashed on the game that you purchased seems a little, just a little cheap. But, like, you know, at least if you're going to do it, have it in the main menu from before you load your game, have like a little banner or something like that. Even that's kind of egregious, but either way, it feels kind of cheap. So hopefully they don't, hopefully that doesn't happen again. And you know, maybe it was just a mistake, but in my opinion, it very much looked like it was, they're probably seeing how much heat or how much trouble this would cause for them to implement something like this. And then they could just be like, oh, whoops, didn't mean to do that. But either way, yeah, so, yeah, Assassin's Creed Mirage is on sale if you're looking to get it, but or at least it was. I don't know if it still is. And it is actually a pretty good game, too. But yeah, I'm not cool with this forced commercial, if that's what they're going to go and do. But anyway, there you go. All right. Another, so this is not a deal. This is an announcement that was made by Larian Studios, makers of Baldur's Gate 3. So they had said that they're soon going to release the information about the Xbox, the impending Xbox release of Baldur's Gate 3, which is set for December. So I assume that during the Game Awards, they're going to announce it's coming in. And I saw some speculation online. Some people think that they're going to shadow drop it to say that Baldur's Gate 3 is available now. And, you know, it's up for so many awards at the award show this year. If it pulls any of those awards, it's also being released. They could see a pretty big boost of sales if they did it that way. And I can see them doing that, but regardless, for Xbox players, it's going to be out at some point in November, or sorry, December at the very least, hopefully sooner than later. So look forward to that if you're on the Xbox platform only and want to pick the game up. It is an amazing game, so you're definitely in for a treat. But the other thing that they announced is that the physical version of Baldur's Gate 3 will be announced shortly too. And then they have shortly after posted a tweet about their plans here. So apparently in Q1 of 2024, there's going to be a physical version of Baldur's Gate 3 launched for all the platforms. So we're including PC. So there's going to be a version for Xbox, PS5, and PC early 2024. And what is going to be included, it's not just the game. It's going to be a deluxe edition, basically. So it's going to contain all the contents from the digital deluxe edition, so all the digital goodies that you get with it, as well, you're going to get some exclusive physical stuff. So included within it is going to be a 3-disc soundtrack on CD, a double-sided map, I guess, of the Sword Coast, I suppose. There's going to be a Mind Flayer poster, and if you're not familiar with Dungeons & Dragons or Baldur's Gate, a Mind Flayer is a monster. They look kind of Cthulhu-esque. They have the tentacles on their face. They're all over the marketing for Baldur's Gate 3. You're also going to get 2 patches, 32 stickers, and a game box that is it's like this deluxe box that it contains it in. It's inspired by those old school big box PC releases of Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 from way back in the day. I remember this so well, and I loved it. I love how they're doing that. That's so cool. And if you have, like me, I have the original versions of Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 still from when I was younger. I still have those big box PC versions for collector's sake, or for collection's sake. But it would be great to get the Baldur's Gate 3 collection as well and be able to put it next to one another to line up, because I guess it's being made to the same dimensions. So very cool that they're doing that. Now, the physical game itself on the Xbox platform is going to come on 3 discs. It can be played offline, so it's all good because it can be on disc. On PlayStation 5, it's going to be on 2 discs. Same idea, still playable offline, just contained on 2 discs. And on the PC physical version, it's actually just going to be a physical, a digital code that you're provided. So you're not going to get a whole bunch of discs to install the game from. It's just going to be a digital download voucher, basically. But cool nonetheless that they're providing this. I think that's really cool. But there's a couple issues. I mean, first of all, it's going to be expensive. It's going to be $79.99 US. So when I saw that price, $79.99, at first I'm like, oh, great, because that's Canadian. That's the price for most of our games here. Well, it was. Now $89.99 is usually the norm. But either way, I thought at first, then I saw, oh, wait, no, that's in US dollars. That means it's going to be much more expensive, because the usual US price is $59.99, I do believe. Yeah, it's going to be a little more expensive. But in honesty, I understand why it's expensive, because all the physical goodies, you know, we're getting. But I think the real issue that I kind of have is the fact that it looks like it's only going to be orderable from the Larian store. So you'll have to go to Larian's website to order from there, which is fine. But then you got to pay a lot of shipping for it, especially for me in Canada. It's going to be relatively expensive, so I don't know that I would want to swing it, especially because I already own it digitally, so I don't think there's really much worth for me to get this, to pay all that extra money for the game plus shipping just to get those physical. I mean, don't get me wrong, I would love to, but yeah, it just seems it's too bad. But I guess for anyone out there who doesn't already have it, this is going to be a great deal. Kind of makes me wish I would have known that this was coming. Although, to be honest, I still wouldn't have waited, because I was really pumped for the game. I loved the first two Baldur's Gate games. But yeah, there you go. That is coming up sometime early next year. So hopefully we'll get a specific date announced for it soon. Okay, and my last bit of news. The Game Awards coming up on December 7th. They've just launched on their website the Player's Choice vote. So in this category, right now they have 30 nominees, and they intend to whittle this down. Basically, they're going to have three rounds of votes and eliminate the lowest voted for items until they have their core list of nominees, and then eventually pick a winner. So the game, the player's choice votes right now, round one, you can go in and see all the 30 nominees, and you can pick 10 of them for this first round. After you pick 10, you can lock that vote in, and then after the round runs out, it'll go into a second round in which you get to pick more. Rinse and repeat, and then the third round, and it whittles it down to the final winner, I guess. But it'll be done over three rounds, so just so you know, that's up there. And if you follow me on X, I have just reposted their post about the Game Awards, so you can find a link directly to it, or you can just look up the Game Awards, and I'm sure it'll be plastered all over. But it sounds like round one, I don't know, I think it ends within like a day or so, at least from the posting of this episode, and round two is set to open on Thursday, November 30th at 9 a.m. Eastern time. So yeah, if you're interested in that stuff, I think it's kind of fun. Just like I said in my previous episode, you know, if you're it's at least it's entertainment value. You know, I don't really take these award shows too seriously, but it's a lot of fun anyway, I think. But there you go. All right, so in terms of games I'm playing in the past week, I've been playing a lot more Mario RPG. Now this game, I'm you know, because I didn't really play it to completion back in the day. I only dabbled with it way back in the Super Nintendo days, but I'm really enjoying my time with it, and I'm also really surprised how short it is so far. Like, I could have easily completed it by now, but I've been interspersing it a lot with RoboCop. I'm still playing a lot of RoboCop Rogue City. I love that game. And Star Ocean 2 Second Story R, which is certainly a much longer role-playing game. But these games have been consuming me, and I've even dabbled a bit more with Baldur's Gate with their recent announcement, and in Zelda as well. So, but mostly it's been Mario RPG, RoboCop, and Star Ocean. And Mario RPG, like I said, I actually really appreciate that it's short. It's pretty straightforward as an RPG, and it's a really fun game. I love the art style. I know they really just did they reimagined the game. It's kind of like what they did with Zelda Link's Awakening on the Switch when they did the remake. They kind of stayed true to the spirit, but sort of reinterpreted it. And it's similar to that in that it has a similar aesthetic, not completely, but similar to that, where it's very true to the spirit of the original Mario RPG. But it still feels fresh and new, and it's a lot of fun to play. This game is great. I love it. And I hope that, like, I know, from what I understand, it's done really well, and I really hope it does, because I would like Nintendo to see how much we like this classic RPG style of game, and I'd like to see more companies noticed this as well, because I know Star Ocean 2, from what I understand, has also done rather well. And I love that old school turn-based RPG that comes out on the console. So I really would like to see a lot more of a return. Like with Final Fantasy 16 this year, it was basically just an action game. So I know it's the controversy is that it's not considered an RPG. And to be quite honest, the only reason I think we consider it as an RPG is because of the heritage of the franchise. But it is an amazing game. It's a fun game, Final Fantasy 16. But it's so far removed from what Final Fantasy games used to be, which is fine. They've always liked to change things up. But like I said, at some point, you know, when is it still considered a role-play game, right? But anyway, I'm getting a little sidelined on that one. But Mario RPG is a lot of fun. So I imagine I'll be finishing it relatively soon. And I've decided that I'm gonna play through a couple Christmas games, given that we are in the holiday season. And I will see. I think I have a little something planned for that for later on in the show, later in December. Just having a little fun experimenting with a couple of these Christmas games. We'll get more into that later. Okay, with that out of the way, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll go into another one of our Retroactive Game of the Year awards, this one starting from 2003. Alright, welcome back. So let's start talking about Game of the Year from 2003 forward. We did from, I believe, the year 2000 through to 2002. So just to recap a little bit, in 2000, we've dramatically increased the amount of nominees. So for 2000, we had Diablo 2, Baldur's Gate 2, Icewind Dale, Final Fantasy 9, Marvel vs. Capcom 2, Nox, Zelda, Majora's Mask, American McGee's Alice, Dragon Warrior 7, and Perfect Dark, and the winner of that year was Diablo 2. For 2001, our nominees were Silent Hill 2, Silent Hill 2, Smash Bros. Melee, Metal Gear Solid 2, Devil May Cry, Halo 1, Grand Theft Auto 3, Eco, Jak and Daxter, Final Fantasy 10, and Sid Meier's Civilization 3, and the winner was Halo 1. And for 2002, our nominees were Metroid Prime, Super Mario Sunshine, Battlefield 1942, Eternal Darkness, Kingdom Hearts, Warcraft 3, Hitman 2, Zelda Wind Waker, Neverwinter Nights, and Elder Scrolls 3. And the winner, of course, was Neverwinter Nights. If you want to hear more details about those and why I picked what I did, check out that episode. But we're starting today with 2003. So without any further ado, this particular year has less nominees than the other year surrounding it. But this year did have some pretty big heavy hitters here. So let's get into it. So first nominee here is Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic. So I remember this game being announced. And this was the game that really made me want to get an Xbox, because this game got announced and I did not have a PC that would be capable enough of running it, but it was also coming out for the Xbox console. It would be exclusive to Xbox. And I loved the idea that BioWare was making an RPG in the Star Wars universe. I loved BioWare RPGs. Of course, I loved all the Dungeons & Dragons ones. Neverwinter Nights in 2002 was the Game of the Year winner for me, and that was a big BioWare RPG. But knowing that they had Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic coming up, the graphics looked amazing in the screenshots. Just the idea of it sounded amazing. And I knew I wanted it. And it was coming for Xbox, so I kind of figured, it makes sense to just get an Xbox then, because it's just a console. And plus, they had Halo, and Halo was wicked too. I had played Halo, and I loved it. I played it a ton before, so to have my own copy of it, I would love it. So that is what made me go out and get an Xbox, was Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic. And I remember getting the console along with the game and coming home with it. And I remember getting home, plugging the console in, and just playing into the evening all night, playing Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic. And I'll be honest, at first when I started playing, it took me a little bit to get into it. But once I got into it, I got really into it. I really got involved with the story. And I remember a friend of mine who was working at EB Games at the time, I would go and see him at EB Games, and I used to smoke back then, and we would go outside on a cigarette break, theorize, because we were kind of playing the game on pace with one another, and so we weren't spoiling it for each other, but we were sort of theorizing what was going to happen in the story, because neither of us had been spoiled on the storyline, and it was just a lot of fun just going to visit my friend for a smoke break and chatting about what could possibly be happening with Star Wars The Knights of the Old Republic, and just theorizing where the story would go. And some of our predictions were correct. Now, if you haven't played the game, I don't want to spoil it. This game is, thankfully, it's playable via backwards compatibility on Xbox One or Xbox Series consoles. But it's also been re-released on the Nintendo Switch. And I can tell you that Nintendo Switch re-release is incredible. It's, in my opinion, completely worth the money to pick up because it's a great game. Still plays great today and a lot of fun. Obviously, the visuals are a bit dated, but it's a great BioWare RPG that you should check out, especially if you like Star Wars. Now, it's also available on Steam on PC, so you can find it there too. But for my money, I think it's best to play on the Switch. And this game really was developed with consoles in mind, but it plays really well on the Switch, I think, and because it's been completely remastered there, whereas the Xbox One, all perfectly serviceable as well, but it's a backwards compatible version. But yeah, so it's very good. All right, the next nomination is Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time. Yet another game that I thought, oh, this is going to be perfect for the Xbox. Because, of course, the Xbox coming out, it was the most powerful console that was available. So although PlayStation 2 was by far the most popular, and Nintendo GameCube was, of course, they had the prestige of being Nintendo, the Xbox was the most powerful. And they were really touting the Xbox as kind of like the PC in a console kind of idea, and it was awesome. I loved Prince of Persia. I remember picking this game up and playing it nonstop as well. But I think the thing that really got me, for some reason, was the fact that the prince could run along the walls and had a lot of like parkour elements. I didn't really care about parkour, but for some reason, it just really clicked with me for this game. And of course, the sort of Arabian Nights fantasy theme really, really resonated with me. I was really into this theme. I loved the original Prince of Persia back in the day, and although this new version of Prince of Persia was nothing at all to do with the original, in terms of how the game played, it still felt like this nice fantasy adventure with an Arabian theme, and I really, really liked it. And I loved the time mechanic, being able to rewind your time. If you had fallen down a pit or missed an enemy or something like that, you could rewind time. And I loved it when you died because the game was always being narrated by the prince as if from the future as he was recounting his story. And if you died, he'd be like, no, wait, that's not how it happened. I just thought that was such a clever little touch. And I remember picking this game up, turning it on, and just I couldn't play anything else until I completed it. And I just completely fell in love with that game. And I probably burnt out my Xbox playing this game over and over again. I really liked it. And I would really love for them to do a remaster / re-release of this game. I know there was a remake that was supposed to happen, but it got mysteriously delayed and basically restarted because it kind of looked a little funny and it sounded like there were some troubles in that production. So that doesn't bother me because I'd rather they take the time to get it right as opposed to release something kind of second rate, so that's fine. But in all honesty, I'd be happy enough if they just re-released the original game in a remastered state. It was so fun. It played so good. My memory of it was how smooth it felt and how fun it felt to play that game. So maybe I'm looking at it with rose-tinted glasses in that way, but it really made an impact on me at the time. All right, the next nominee is Silent Hill 3, a game that came out for the PlayStation 2. That, of course, I love Silent Hill 1 and I loved Silent Hill 2, but number 3 came out kind of, for me, it was kind of unexpectedly. You're kind of like in this, I just remember a lot of the amusement park themes to it, and I remember being just, it was surprisingly very dark. At least I shouldn't say surprisingly, because Silent Hill 1 and 2 are also very dark, but this one just came at a time that when I was playing it, I just remember thinking, wow, this is a really dark game, and it really like, I remember playing it at night and just feeling just sort of this darkness kind of floating around me after playing it. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It was really good at evoking this atmosphere and this mood. And it was, although I think Silent Hill 2 will always be my favorite of the franchise, this really did hit well with what it was trying to accomplish. And I think that there is definitely an argument for saying that this is the strongest Silent Hill game. And if they are, because I know they're remaking Silent Hill 2, I really hope that they remake Silent Hill 3 as well as the first one too. I mean, I know Shattered Memories, is that what it's called, was technically a remake of part one, but I'd like to see a modern, more literal remake of the first one, but as well as Silent Hill 3. I consider the first three to be basically a classic trilogy, 1, 2, and 3. So definitely this game was one of those big hitters for the year for me. All right, another game. So that, funny enough, I remember this game being kind of, to me, I always thought of it as the underdog because Battlefield 1942 had come out the year before and was a real big hit, and it was a lot of fun because you played that one online, a lot of multiplayer, and it really sort of redefined what you could do with a multiplayer shooter. But this next game, little did I realize it was going to eventually completely dominate the first-person shooter genre, especially multiplayer, and that is Call of Duty. The original Call of Duty. The original World War II Call of Duty was only on the PC at the time, and like I said, it was kind of the underdog compared to the big giant of Battlefield 1942. But this game came out to absolute critical acclaim, and that's what caught my interest. I was like, oh, lots of people are saying this is like incredible. So I ended up checking this game out and being, wow, it really captures the raw intensity of World War II. And it felt like, well, you're really this soldier in the trenches. And oh my gosh, it, at the time, again, based on the technology at the time, it felt like this is something that I never thought I'd be able to see in a video game and experience in a video game before. And I just remember it kind of stole the lunch of games like Medal of Honor and stuff like that, which were always trying for that kind of thing. But Call of Duty was the one that really got it. And this, of course, was before it became the multiplayer behemoth that it is today. Completely different kind of game than what we have today. But this game was incredible. And really only went uphill from there. But that initial inaugural entry made such an impact on people. And when you played it at that time, you could easily understand why it was such a sensation. This game played amazingly, and it just felt like it had this realism to it in an arcadey sort of way, but still, like, it felt very authentic playing this game, and it was so fun. And I always think of that game as almost like a different franchise altogether, knowing what it is now. It feels so removed from that, but I really liked it. And every time they revisit the World War II scenario, I know I hear people sometimes groan anytime Call of Duty goes back to that setting. I love it. I personally love it. And it all stems back to that first Call of Duty. All right. And another game that came out that year, which was a pretty big deal in relation to one of the games I'm playing today, and that is Mario & Luigi Superstar Saga. So this was Mario & Luigi back at another RPG style of game. So ever since Mario RPG came out for the SNES, and of course Nintendo's at the time split with Square Enix, they never really followed up on Mario RPG. There was never a Mario RPG 2. Instead, we got two RPG successors, and one of them, of course, being Paper Mario for the Nintendo 64 and subsequent systems on the consoles. But on the handhelds, we got the Mario and Luigi RPG games. So Superstar Saga was the first in the Mario and Luigi games. And this series pits you controlling both Mario and Luigi in a role-playing story. The thing with Superstar Saga, and Superstar Saga was amazing, was that it's on the Game Boy Advance, and it was just this really weird story, just really kind of out there, but it was like with Bean Kingdom or whatever it was. But I remember playing this game over Christmas thinking like, oh man, this is like a really epic adventure, and it's on the Game Boy. Like, a lot of people like knew of its existence, but I think a lot of people overlooked it because I was like, oh, it's just a Game Boy game. But in the meantime, I'm having what I feel is like a console level epic role-playing game, but on the Game Boy, starring Mario and Luigi. This is wicked, man. And like I said, I think this and Paper Mario, the first Paper Mario, were the first ones to make me think, I think I really missed out on not fully playing Mario RPG, because when Mario RPG came out on the SNES, my mind was already towards the next generation of consoles. But with this made me think, wow, there's really something there. I want to go back and play Mario RPG now, but I was really obviously stuck in the current day at the time, so playing the Paper Mario and Mario and Luigi Superstar Saga. And Superstar Saga really, really impressed me at the time. I just remember playing it over Christmas thinking, this is a really special game. And I still have my copy. I love that game. I even bought the remake for the Nintendo DS, or was it 3DS, all those years later, and played through it again. And I love that game. I think it's awesome. So definitely a Game of the Year contender. And lastly, another Mario epic that came out, and also came out to a little bit of controversy that year, was Mario Kart Double Dash, of course. So controversy because I remember at the time, I think it was IGN that gave it a 7.9 or 7 point something, and kind of didn't like it. There's, in fact, critically, it didn't do well. It seemed to be one of those games that got panned a little bit by the critics. So similar to what I talked about in my review culture episode last week, this was a game that almost seemed to have some sort of coordinated attack on it, although I don't necessarily know that that was the case, but I couldn't understand why, because the game I was playing, I was like, this is a lot of fun. So for the longest time, I remember thinking, is there something wrong with me? Like, why do I enjoy this game so much? It's apparently supposed to be pretty bad. And then, of course, it turned out most people actually really loved Double Dash, and for good reason. Having the two riders as a mechanic was awesome. Being able to store an item that way, it opened up so many strategies. And of course, being on the GameCube, it was a next-gen tech at the time, so it looked amazing. And it really opened the floodgates. I thought this was such an amazing game. If only this game had, if we had online technology in the consoles as standard back then, like we do today, would have been awesome. But yeah, this game would, in my opinion, would only ever be bested by Mario Kart 8 on the consoles. So Mario Kart Double Dash was so much fun. I thought it was amazing. And still to this day, I think it still stands the test of time as being an excellent entry in Mario Kart. If you ever have a chance to play this original GameCube classic, absolutely take it up and you'll have a ton of fun. This game was awesome. All right, so yeah, with that, the Game of the Year winner for 2003 is Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time. Because let me tell you, this game was just, it had everything. It was the epic story, the epic long story, the different way of playing, like the parkour was so well implemented. I had never played a game like that before. Coupled with the clever narrative function of being narrated the game by the future prince, and you know, the clever use of humor, I guess, quirkiness, I guess, but also just sort of the epic scope of it. It just felt so amazing to be ascending these massive structures, and just the combat felt so good. And you know, and later on in the game when you're fighting these more advanced enemies and bouncing between all these difficult situations, you felt like a true master. And again, that Arabian fantasy flavor was just magnificent. I thought they did a spectacular job with this game. And like I said, I would love for them to remaster and re-release just the original, this game and its two sequels. Again, I would love to see it return. I mean, there's a reason why when they decided to make a movie of Prince of Persia, why they chose Sands of Time to be the basis for that, because this game was incredible. And yeah, for sure, my absolute game of the year for 2003, no question. Okay, so with that out of the way, let's get on to the year 2004. Okay, so 2004 saw the return of a couple of, actually quite a number of heavy hitter franchises. So let's get into the nominees. We have Metal Gear Solid 3, Snake Eater. This was the return of Snake as the prime hero, although not Solid Snake. It was the big boss character, technically. And this game was amazing. This was with Metal Gear 2. I loved Metal Gear 2 quite a bit, or Metal Gear Solid 2 quite a bit. But there was definitely that shock of having to play as Raiden for most of the game that you didn't expect. But in retrospect, that is an amazing game, of course, despite that. But Metal Gear Solid 3, probably of the classic MGS games, although I really like number one quite a bit as well. Metal Gear Solid 3 is probably my favorite one. I love how they had this game take place in the 60s and how they were able to interpret the different technologies they had in a 1960 sense and how those different characters looked at the time. And it was just, everything about it was amazing. And, you know, especially going forward in Metal Gear Solid 4 eventually and having those characters return in a futuristic kind of setting and seeing how time had ravaged them in some ways. But Metal Gear Solid 3 introduced us some amazing characters, had just this excellent storyline. And it was, again, it was like a continuation of the brilliance of Kojima, because his storytelling and his storytelling through the use of game mechanics were second to none. I think he outdid himself on this one. I think this is one of the best Metal Gear Solid games, and most definitely a solid entry in the Game of the Year nominees for 2004. I loved this one. All right, and yet another big franchise that made a return. This one is first return since it's a first release. This is Half-Life 2. This is a monumental release for a number of reasons. Number one, the Half-Life franchise grew huge when the first one came out, and it was amazing. But Half-Life 2 took it to a whole new level. Its new the new source engine it was using looked amazing. It was unlike any. I think it had a new PC right around the time, so I was seeing it with the bleeding edge visuals. Oh god, it just looked amazing. The cinematics, the way that they told their stories and maintained gameplay throughout the whole thing without having to have these cutscenes, like you experience the game. It was masterful storytelling as a game, and it did not sacrifice anything about being a game. The crazy guns, like the gravity gun, and some of the stuff that they came up with in this game was just amazing. And it was this hard dystopian sci-fi setting, and it was just amazing. Everything about it just felt so fully realized, unlike anything else out there at the time. Now, another monumental part of this release was, of course, the beginning of Steam, because this is their launcher was Steam, and this is what you had to have in order to play Half-Life 2. Now, of course, we know today what has happened with Steam is that it is one of the primary platforms for all PC games, so this launched Steam as well, which, a bit of a blessing and a curse. Blessing in that it's a great platform to play your games from, a curse because Valve got so wrapped up with Steam that they never got around to making Half-Life 3. We did eventually see a couple great expansions to Half-Life 2, but the core Half-Life 2 game, this is a game you can still go back to today, and it still feels modern today. I mean, sure, the visuals don't look quite as good. They don't look terrible either, but this game still feels and basically is like a very like modern game made with modern design sensibilities, at least in my opinion. I think this game is amazing. I think a lot of people would even consider this to be the greatest game of all time. But yeah, Half-Life 2 is amazing. All right, and another game on our nomination list for this year is yet another game that is a returning franchise that was returning with a lot of anticipation, and that is, of course, another huge first-person shooter on the console front this time, Halo 2. Ah, man, I remember the hype leading up to this game. Halo had made such a huge name for itself and for Xbox that the anticipation of Halo 2 was off the charts for a couple reasons. Obviously for the campaign, the continuation of Master Chief's storyline, but also this was the first game that would be coming out with the support for the newly launched Xbox Live, which brought online play to all to consoles, basically. And being able to play Halo 2 officially online on all these different online servers was going to be amazing. And Bungie did an amazing job at setting this service up for success. I remember having Half-Life 2 pre-ordered and waiting in line in front of my EB Games for the midnight release. And I remember there was a little kid in the line just in front of me, and his father was with him. And I was chatting with them, and the father... And this was funny because it was on a weekday, so it wasn't even like coming out on a Friday or something like that, or on a whatever. It was a weekday, and it was the night before, of course. So I remember saying like, "Oh, your son doesn't have school?" And he's like, "Well, no, he does, but he's going to be calling in tomorrow. I just told the school it's a cultural holiday." It made me laugh, but I remember thinking like, "Oh man, that'd be awesome to have a parent like that that's supporting your interests like that. That's wicked." But yeah, so I'll always remember that interaction I had with that father and his son as they were excitedly waiting for Halo 2. And as the line got closer and closer, we saw that they had TVs on and they had a couple employees and they're playing Halo 2 in the lobby just to get everyone hyped up for it. So it was so, it just felt like such a big event, and it was like everywhere around the world was having midnight launches for Halo 2, and it was just this gigantic, huge event for Xbox at the time. So I'll always remember that. That was a pretty big deal when that game released. So, and but I'll always remember that was one of the more fun midnight releases I ever had, was for Halo 2. And of course, the game itself, I remember playing it the next day, and I had a service guy coming into my place to help set something up for me, and he stopped and watched me playing. This is the day of release. You know, I had slept in after because I had done the midnight release, and I remember just playing it in my apartment at the time, and this guy, this service guy came in to do something. He's like, oh, is this the new Halo? And he sat in my living room for ages watching me play Halo, and we just started chatting about how great Halo was, and it was just, you kind of bonded with people about this game. It was so cool. But yeah, no, Halo 2, I played it right up to its controversial ending, and I played that online multiplayer for like an eternity. And this was also during it, you know, you hear people talk about online play today when they're in the chat lobbies and all this like nasty stuff that people say now online. But at this was the time people were still very excited to be playing. I remember talking with people I didn't know, just talking to these other guys who were like, oh man, I can't wait to play this game online. It's going to be so fun in the setup. And these are strangers who didn't know each other and like finishing games. Like, yeah, that was a great game. Good job. So it was, there's a lot more positivity, I guess, online because people were just so excited. Obviously, yeah, sure. You also got some nasty smack talk moments too, but yeah, it was just, the whole thing was just the whole package of an event game. All right, the next game on my list is Grand Theft Auto San Andreas. Yet another massive franchise getting another installment. So Grand Theft Auto 3 was a huge deal. And then, of course, they did Grand Theft Auto Vice City, which took place in the 80s in a Miami type of a situation. Now, this was more of a Los Angeles, modern-day Los Angeles kind of scenario. But this time they had really put significant effort into presenting the storyline where you played CJ, a character. You know, to be honest, with Grand Theft Auto, I often got partway through the story and I never really ever finished them. And that's true of three, Vice City, San Andreas, 4 and 5. I've never really finished the stories just because you end up, at least I always end up just getting so caught up with the open world stuff and it's causing chaos that I lose sight of what I'm doing. But Grand Theft Auto 3, to me, felt like a huge step forward from the previous two entries, and felt really like, because I liked Vice City a lot, the theme, but I felt like it was kind of more of the same, just a different coat of paint. Whereas this one felt like there was a lot more added to it. Like CJ could swim, he rode bicycles, and the control just felt tighter, the graphics were tighter, the presentation was just better, the story was better, everything about it was just better. And as in my mind, I remember thinking, like, this really could have just been Grand Theft Auto 4. This is such a solid entry, they didn't need to keep it sort of separated from that. But yeah, and I think history looks very kindly on this entry, even though obviously the looks wise it kind of looks rough now, product of its time, right? But yeah, Grand Theft Auto San Andreas was a really big deal, and they of course had that whole hot coffee scandal back in the day where there was hidden adult content in the code that was blocked off, but because they didn't disclose it, they had to change the rating and take the game off the shelves and re-edit it to completely remove it from the game's code. So very interesting stuff, but that was a great game and absolutely worthy of a nomination. All right, the next nominee, Star Wars Battlefront. So this basically took the Battlefield 1942 approach of these giant epic battlefields and put a Star Wars coat of paint over it. And I think they did a really good job. They had nailed the aesthetics, the sound, the music, the graphics, and with that addictive Battlefield style of play, I think this game was amazing. And I'm glad that this series saw sequels and eventual remakes in the more modern ages, and I think this is such an amazing game, and it really nailed that feeling of a big epic Star Wars battle from back then. So this game was tons of fun and really captured everything I liked about Battlefield 1942, and like I said, just applied it to Star Wars. So great game. The next one, this is a long list of nominees. Mortal Kombat Deception. So I was not too big on Mortal Kombat Deadly Alliance, which came up before, because they moved into sort of this pseudo 3D fighter. And I don't know, something about it I just didn't like. The whole death of Liu Kang was cool, and Quan Chi and Shang Tsung teaming up. But something about it, I didn't connect with me as much. So I was expecting the same from Mortal Kombat Deception. It had this really dark sort of tone about it. There was undead, Liu Kang was a character. And I don't know, it's just something about it just didn't click with me at first, or I didn't think it was going to click with me. But Mortal Kombat Deception absolutely hit the nail on the head. Once I started playing it, it just felt tighter to me. The gameplay was a lot of fun. You know, I connected with the characters, with the storyline and the themes in this game, and I loved all the this. I think this was the first one where they introduced a whole bunch of extra modes. I don't know if this is the one that had the chess mode in it or the go-kart, but they had a whole bunch of extra modes added into the game, and it just felt like, wow, this is a really complete package. And this game at the time felt to me like this was a celebration of what Mortal Kombat was up to that point. So it's almost like a loving look back at its past without giving in to its 2D roots. Didn't just remake the 2D games, but I felt like this was a good way of still remaining a 3D game, but capturing the essence of what made the original Mortal Kombat game so great. And I loved it. In fact, I was obsessed with this game for quite a long time. And of course, obviously having the online play, although, you know, the online connectivity was never super hot, but this was an amazing game. And I still look back, and whenever I think about this game, I always look back on it very longingly. I ended up buying the PlayStation Vita port, although not so great, just because I really liked this game quite a bit. Or sorry, was it PSP? I can't remember. There was a portable version of it anyway. But yeah, no, this game was absolutely worthy of that nomination. All right, another one, Spider-Man 2. The not the one released this year, but the movie video game. So Spider-Man 2 was the hot new movie in the theaters with the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man, the one with Dr. Octopus. This was the movie version of that game. But instead of just doing a cheap cash-in, they made like an open world. I remember seeing a lot of headlines and reviews saying, Grand Theft Spider-Man, because they made an open world Spider-Man game. And it was amazing. I just skipped these licensed game at this point because I thought it was crap. But this one, I kept hearing about how great it was, and the idea that it was an open-world Spider-Man, and you could just swing around the city. I was like, this sounds cool, man. I would love to play a Spider-Man in a game like that. And sure enough, even though it was based on the movie, you wouldn't really necessarily think that, because it was just so, it just felt like an open-world Spider-Man game. And none of the other Spider-Man games at this time were able to ever match it, including Spider-Man 3, the video game, which came later. But Spider-Man 2, something about it, they just put their passion into making this open-world Spider-Man game, and this wouldn't be topped basically until the Insomniac game came out in, 2018 or 2019, whenever it came out. But this game was amazing. And what was a bonus is that some of the members of KMFDM, if you're familiar with their music, were responsible for the soundtrack. So I loved everything about this game, and I played it way longer than I need. And I remember I was in the middle of moving somewhere at the time, and I remember having being surrounded by boxes as I was getting ready to move, and having pulled out the TV and hooking up, because I had it on Xbox, hooking up my Xbox and playing it in cramped quarters, just because I loved the game so much and I didn't want to just wait till I moved into my next place. So I loved this game. It was a lot of fun. I always have fond memories of it. Moving is always very stressful, but this was something that helped to ease that stress. All right, and the next game is Rome Total War, a huge PC strategy game. I was a real big fan of the Total War series. I loved the medieval one, but I never had a computer previous to this that could run it very well from the last Total War release. But now that I had a newer PC from the year before, I had enough horsepower that I could run Rome Total War. And it was amazing just playing this grand historical game, commanding armies. There's nothing like it to be able to play a game like that and feel like you have the control over these armies. And on top of that, outside of just the battlefield stuff, you would have this strategy map of moving your armies around. Anyway, it's the whole package, really. And it's still standing. They eventually, years later, made a sequel to this game because it stood the test of time. And I think even today, I thought they did. They do a remaster of it. They might have. I'm not sure, but it's definitely worth playing. Although it's maybe a little bit rougher now, and they've had a whole bunch of different Total Wars. Obviously, they decided they had a lot of success with the more recent Warhammer Fantasy ones, but they've just recently released Pharaoh, the Egyptian one, on Steam, and that someday in the near future, I'd like to pick that up when I have a chance. But because I really like the formula of Total War. Just commanding those grand armies and the overlaying strategy on top of it. Just a winning formula. And Rome is probably one of the best versions they ever did so far today of the historical kind. All right, so two more entries here. The first one, World of Warcraft. So Warcraft 3, I remember that one coming out with a trailer attached to it for this upcoming MMO game for World of Warcraft. And this would be the first time you got to go down and just control an individual character, one of your own creation. So this game, I started beta testing it. And I was a big EverQuest player at the time still. As you know, that was my previous game of the year, winner of previous year. But World of Warcraft was coming, and it was being touted as an EverQuest killer. But we had heard that so many times. But this time, it felt very possible, because this is Blizzard. Blizzard only made hits, basically, at this point. And Warcraft was a beloved franchise. I got to play the beta test of this, and I loved it. It looked amazing. And the graphics, they still to this day look good. It looked amazing. And just they basically took a lot of frustrations from the MMO games of the day and made a lot of quality of life changes to those systems and made it so approachable for everyone. And I remember there's a guy that, again, this is the same guy that I was playing Knights of the Old Republic with and having smoke breaks with and talking about. He was he got me the beta code, and he said, hey, under one condition. And I also, at the same time, had a beta code to EverQuest 2, and he loved EverQuest as well. And he was playing with the World of Warcraft one, but he didn't have the EverQuest. And he said, hey, man, I'm going to come over to your place and play EverQuest. So, I mean, I knew him well enough that I went to go visit and have smokes with him, but he and I had never hung out like that. So I was like, oh, that's kind of weird, you just invited yourself over. But I was like, okay, cool, whatever. And I remember him coming over, and we just bonded over playing World of Warcraft and EverQuest 2. But World of Warcraft, we both eventually got way more into and eventually started playing together after the game launched. And I remember that Christmas, all season long, was always World of Warcraft. And it blew me away that, like, you would be in Ironforge in the Dwarven Mountains, and at Christmas time, it would be decorated for Christmas, and I was like, oh my gosh, this game is amazing. The music, the like, you could just feel it. Like, when you're in the wintry airs, it felt cold kind of thing, right? And when you're in, I loved how the daylight hours matched the time zone daylight hours that you were playing in, and same with nighttime. So you'd be playing, you see, oh, it's getting late now in the game, and that means it's getting late in real life. So I just loved everything about it, and I think to this day it's still probably one of the absolute best massively multiplayer games out there. And it's having a bit of a resurgence lately given their recent expansion. I mean, there was a reason why they were the most successful MMO ever and continue to be still a highly played MMO. Obviously, they're well past their glory days, but this original release of World of Warcraft was such a huge ordeal, and I loved it. Okay, and my last nomination for this particular year is Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines. Obviously, if you know my other show, Saving Throws, you know that I am a big tabletop role-playing game fan, and Vampire the Masquerade was always a game I really enjoyed playing back in the day. And, of course, there was previously a Vampire the Masquerade, I think it was called Redemption, video game for the PC that I really liked, but Bloodlines was this much more advanced role-playing game. And although it was a pretty buggy game when it came out, the amount of options that you had in this game was unlike anything else. And kind of the way we talk about Baldur's Gate 3 today was how the Vampire Masquerade Bloodlines felt at the time, where it just felt like you could just do anything you wanted. You could build your character whatever way, take any kind of role-playing option you wanted. And this very closely mimicked the feeling of playing the vampire tabletop role-playing game. So for that alone, it was just this magnificent feat. And to be honest, that reputation this game has still stands to this day, that there is a sequel plan. And all these years later, about 20 years later, and Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2 should be probably coming in, I think, next year at some point. But they've been talking about it for a while. So I'm really hyped for that game, particularly because I love the first one so much. And it stood the test of time, although, again, dated visually. It is still a fun game to play, and you can get a lot of value out of it. But again, there still remains some bugs. So anyway, with all that out of the way, it's time to crown the winner for the Game of the Year 2004. And that award goes to World of Warcraft. This game I spent so much time with, and even in the launch year alone, it had this certain magic that no other game was able to match that particular year. I think World of Warcraft was a huge revelation, and it did the unthink, because, I mean, playing EverQuest, most people didn't know what that was. I mean, it was popular enough, but a lot of people I would tell about, they'd be like, oh, okay, sounds cool, but I don't know. And it's not for me, and people were always turned off by the monthly subscription fee, of course. But World of Warcraft had the aesthetic. It was easily understandable, and anyone who just tried it, even for a little bit, completely got it right away and got hooked on it quite often. I had a lot of friends who weren't necessarily too into video games from the tabletop gaming side of life, or even from no games at all, right, like work friends and stuff, who were curious about it because they heard so much about World of Warcraft, and it really just, it hooked a lot of people in. And I remember having a few of my friends playing that we all formed up and made a guild together and had a lot of fun. Just the multiplayer aspect, but even just playing by yourself, the aesthetic, everything about it, they did not spare any talent on this. Everything, whether you played it solo, in a group, however you played it, this game delivered. It had great lore behind it. If you were just playing just for because it looked pretty, it supported that. It ran on a variety of systems, so you didn't have to have bleeding edge technology to play it. It was amazing, and it stands absolutely, to this day, it still stands as one of the only massively multiplayer role-playing games now that you still have to pay a subscription for when most have gone free to play. This game, and it's still worth that money because it is an amazing, amazing game. Still worth playing today. But yeah, World of Warcraft is definitely the winner for that year. Okay, so I think I can probably squeeze one more year in before we call it a day here. So let's get through this one a little quicker. This is 2005. We have a number of big games coming out this year. Again, a lot of sequels here too. But let's start it off. Number one, God of War. First appearance of this franchise. I remember it being announced for PlayStation 2. And, you know, having spent some time in Greek Town, I thought, oh, this is kind of cool to be able to play God of War. This is a game all about Greek mythology. It was this hyper-violent, super action-oriented, Western-developed game. So it was cool because I wanted to see what the Western take was on this sort of, what I thought of at the time was a Devil May Cry style of action game. That's the way I looked at it. But it was based on Greek mythology, and it was just hyper-violent and hyper-mature. And the graphics were amazing, and just all the set pieces, it was just a spectacular, it was like a tentpole AAA summer blockbuster style of a game. And but it lived up to it, and it was a good quality game. It was like, it had heart, it had a really good story, it was very well played or thought out, but the gameplay was amazing. And to this day, I think this gameplay is even better than the more recent God of War games. I think this classic one had so much to it that it's just so much fun to play. I love the action combat in this game. And this game definitely a worthy contender for Game of the Year. All right, the next one, a huge sequel that came out that reinvented the franchise, and that is Resident Evil 4. Came out as a GameCube exclusive. It looked incredible, and it was hyper-violent. In fact, the violence was to a point, with like especially that beheading moment with a chainsaw, where it was really kind of graphic and kind of startled some people, I think. But the storyline moved away from the traditional zombies and kind of went into different directions with Leon Kennedy, and got away from Raccoon City, and we got the Las Plagas situation. And this game was, again, it was a huge deal because, hey, Nintendo GameCube just got this killer exclusive that isn't coming anywhere else. However, of course, as we all know, it eventually came out on PlayStation 2, and then basically it's been on every platform since then. And this is the game that most people think of as the quintessential Resident Evil game. And of course, it was its well-deserved reputation. It nails the atmosphere, the tension, the horror. Everything about it was amazing. And I love how they finally broke away from the Raccoon City story. I love those original stories from Resident Evil 1, 2, 3. But it was time to, like, they didn't need to rehash it because that stuff had been done perfectly already. So it was great to see them expand further. And this also brought in changes to the control scheme. You no longer had the tank controls, although you couldn't run and shoot at the same time. But still, the tank controls being gone felt so great to have a more modern feeling control scheme to this game. But everything you had going for Resident Evil 4 was absolutely the right step. And it's to this day, because they did the remake this year, was very faithful to that original release. There's a reason why it was so successful. I would even say Resident Evil 2 remake, Resident Evil 3 remake that they recently did is very much done thanks to the conventions of Resident Evil 4, the over-the-shoulder third-person style action that they pioneered there. So this is a very influential game, very good game. All right, Call of Duty 2 was also released this year and also ends up on this, because everything I said about Call of Duty absolutely applies here, except amped up to the next level. And this time, this was a development studio that understood the talent it had and absolutely leveraged that to make a worthy sequel. I remember getting this for the Xbox 360 when it came out, because I got an Xbox 360 shortly after launch because the stock was kind of constrained. But this is one of those launch games that I picked up early on. And I remember thinking, I'm not going to bother. It looks like more of the same. But I ended up picking it up just because there wasn't a whole lot of games to play for the 360. And then thinking, oh my gosh, this game is amazing. And it was. It was awesome. It was one of the best games on the 360 when it came out. And I played it for so long. And again, little did I know what Call of Duty was going to turn into, but this is one of the best games that they ever released in the franchise in the World War II setting. They definitely one-upped what they did with the first one, so absolutely a worthy game. Another great game that had come out and near the end of the Xbox cycle, and of course PS2, was Psychonauts. Now, Psychonauts, on its release, was this crazy new platformer, was very stylistic, and I was really kind of skeptical of it at the time because I thought, you know what, this game is purporting to be this great new direction, but it looks like just kind of like another platformer that is claiming to be all sorts of awesome stuff, but they're really not going to be anything like what we get with something like Mario 64. But in fact, I was wrong. Psychonauts was actually amazing. You know, I put off playing this one for quite a long time just because I had this preconceived notion of it. And I eventually picked it up and I rented it at the time and played it and immediately thought, whoa, this one really does live up. This is a Tim Schafer game. So I really wasn't familiar with him. But this is the reason that I know who Tim Schafer was after this, because of this game. Because this game was so awesome. It was so much style. The mechanics were tight. The game was just so fun and had a lot of replayability. And in fact, they did a re-release of it on PS4 as well later on. And I picked that one up as well. And I played through it again. And of course, the sequel, which came out later, was amazing. So lucky that we got a sequel. But this first one was, for the longest time, was this cult classic, and I think ended up getting a lot of recognition because of how good it was. All right, my next nominee is Dragon Quest VIII, Journey of the Cursed King. This game was, again, a huge release for PS2 because it looked, they were using cell shading for their graphics, and it looked like a cartoon, and it just, you know, I played Dragon Quest VII briefly before, but Dragon Quest kind of disappeared for me at the time because it was actually Dragon Warrior. And then this is the first title that came out under the original title as Dragon Quest, because they settled a long-standing rights dispute so they could release their game in their original title from Japan. And Dragon Quest VIII, not only was it like a reattempt to make the franchise relevant in North America, they also launched it. It was the special edition version that launched with this nice cardboard box, but it came with a demo for Final Fantasy XII. And of course, I was super excited for that. And the only way to play it was to get Dragon Quest VIII. But I mean, I was already a big Dragon Quest fan anyway, so I was going to buy Dragon Quest VIII no matter what. It's just a bonus. You got Final Fantasy XII with it. But I think because of that, it got a lot of people really interested in picking up Dragon Quest VIII. It's the classic Dragon Quest gameplay. A great storyline. And the graphics were amazing. The music, obviously amazing, especially now that we had a full orchestrated soundtrack. But Dragon Quest VIII really took me by surprise. Just like I said, I only dabbled a bit with 7. And before that, because we never got the Super Nintendo releases back then, before that, Dragon Warrior 1, 2, 3, and 4 were on the NES. So it was a huge leap from what we had before to present day to come to Dragon Quest VIII to see, oh my gosh, we've been missing out on all this stuff all this time. This game is amazing. And it blew my mind. I played that game like, it got difficult too, but I played it like crazy. And I absolutely loved this game. I really, like, they did a DS. A Nintendo 3DS remake of this game, but I would love for them to remake the PS2 release proper for the Nintendo Switch and all modern platforms to retain the animation or the cel shading graphics that they had back then, plus the soundtrack as well, because I think the PS2 version is probably the best version of this game. I love it. Okay, the next nominee is Prince of Persia, The Two Thrones. So this was the sequel to Sands of Time, which was one of my previous Game of the Year winners. And this game went in a little more of a grittier direction. So it kind of dropped a little bit of the whimsical and humorous nature of the previous one and made it a lot more darker. Now, it was a very dark fantasy kind of vibe. And it turned off a lot of people, but I was really into it. I really liked it. Not because it was cool, but just because I liked the new tone. It was fun. It was gritty and dark, but it still retained this epicness to it that I really liked. And I thought it was really good. It really upped the difficulty and the action to the game was really up there, but it retained those fun mechanics of parkour and everything that you got from the first game in a new, darker sort of setting. And I really like this game quite a bit. And I should also say that I didn't mention that Warrior Within was the second one that came out before, too. It was kind of a combination of Warrior Within, that's where the darkness came from, as well as a combination of Sands of Time. And because there was two different voice actors that voiced the prince between those games, they got them both back in the same one, and he had two dueling personalities, and it was the completion to the story. But it was this grittier, darker sort of end to this trilogy that had been running for the past little while, and I really liked how it all came together. So I think this game was amazing, and it was a fitting end to that particular trilogy. Like I said, this one and Warrior Within before it didn't really do it for a lot of people. I think the Sands of Time stood for a lot of people as the best one, but I love this whole series, 1, 2, and 3, and I like the direction they went into it with it. The whimsical nature of the first, the hardcore darkness of the second, and the sort of gritty meeting of the two in this one, and it was just the perfect end to this series. I think it was amazing. All right, next up we have Sid Meier's Civilization 4. This revolutionized the Civilization franchise. It took it away from its roots. Like Civ 3 felt a lot like a more of a souped up Sim 2 or Civ 2, whereas Civilization 4 felt like more like a reimagining of Civilization. They introduced religion to the game and a lot more victory conditions to it. They had that excellent theme song that played for the game, which was actually quite a big ordeal. I think it turned into a bit of a hit. And this game really like opened the door for a lot of people who had never had experience with Civilization before. And I think this game stands as a lot of people's favorite entry in the series, and for good reason. I think this was one of the best of those original Civilization games, and like I said, they really sort of freed themselves up a bit from the confines of the previous ones in order to add a lot more functionality to the game. And Civilization, when I get in the mood for Civilization, it's hard to get out of it. I really love this series. All right, next up, Battlefield 2. So Battlefield 1942 was the first title of this series. Like I said, that started off as a big gun, and then they did Battlefield Vietnam and some other stuff, but Battlefield 2 was the first true sequel, and this was a modern-day warfare game. And the graphics at the time felt to me like they were photorealistic. They looked incredible, but the maps were amazing. The vehicle, the warfare felt brutal, chaotic, and just amazing. I loved Battlefield 2. I still have such fond memories of this game. I'm sure it doesn't stand the test of time as well anymore. And this is where I started to understand that Battlefield as a series was always chasing after the bleeding edge of technology, because I remember I had to upgrade my computer to get this game running well. And I did it specifically for Battlefield 2 because I loved it so much. And I played it online for quite a long period of time. And I still have very fond memories thinking back, but my memory tells me that this game looked amazing. I'm pretty sure it doesn't look nearly as good as my memory is telling me right now, but I will always have really fond memories of playing Battlefield 2. Devil May Cry 3 was a, which is the next entry here. That was another title that, you know, another game that got a sequel. That was an improvement. So Devil May Cry 2 was a little bit of a disappointment critically and commercially, I think, after the first one was so good. I never even really played Devil May Cry 2. But Part 3, you could tell just from the screenshots and gameplay that this game was, they put a solid effort in here. So I ended up buying 2 and 3 afterwards just to get caught up on the story. And this game was amazing. It was very much a love letter to that franchise, where 2 did kind of slip up a little bit, I thought. And number 3 was really like a course correction, bringing things back on track. I do like 2, don't get me wrong. But number 3 was really the culmination of everything they had learned from the first game, which felt like a masterpiece. The second game, which, you know, maybe not quite as good, but they learned in every title. And this one came out as sort of the crescendo of everything they had done. And I still think that this game was even better than Devil May Cry 4, which came later. This game was awesome. And, you know, they have re-released it several times, so you can play it on most modern platforms today easily. But yeah, Devil May Cry 3, absolutely worthy of a Game of the Year nomination for this particular year. And my last nomination for 2005... is, of course, a huge behemoth of an entry, both literally and figuratively, and that is Shadow of the Colossus. This game came out, and this game looks like it was an impossible game. Knowing this game was running on PlayStation 2 hardware, which was aging pretty badly at the time, this game looks incredible. The whole idea that you are scaling these gigantic creatures and trying to kill them, execute them, because you're being told to kill these creatures in order to revive your ailing girlfriend. That was an amazing game, and it really made you think a lot about, like, why, what are these creatures, though, and is it right what I'm doing? But just how each creature was kind of like a level and a puzzle in and of itself, figuring out how to scale them, how to take them down, and also even how to locate them and how to get a hold of them. There were some creatures that were flying, some of them that were swimming. The sense of scale in this game and the sort of fragile nature of your character, it was just very awe-inspiring. And I haven't had that feeling in the game really since that time. But I would say that they did an amazing, Blue Point Games did an amazing remake of this for the PS4. And if you're going to play it today, I just say go ahead and play that remake, because they absolutely nail everything that this game had. But this game is amazing, and it was a real technical and artistic achievement for video games at the time. I love it. Such an amazing game. Absolutely worthy of a Game of the Year nomination. But my Game of the Year winner for the year of 2005 goes to Dragon Quest VIII, Journey of the Cursed King. This was a classic franchise brought into the modern day, brought to the West very successfully and beautifully. And they didn't sacrifice anything about what made it Dragon Quest, but they also didn't fall into irrelevancy. They made it work in a modern-day setting, that this turn-based RPG was able to have this epic adventure that felt whimsical and very grand, at the same time felt very modern and very just like nothing you'd ever seen before. And I think I played this game like crazy. It got very difficult, but you really wanted to press on. The combination of the aesthetic, the classic tried and true gameplay, the obviously incredible music, and the, like I said, the visuals were incredible. And just the gameplay just felt so good to play this game. It felt so refreshing. And it's kind of had that feeling again when Dragon Quest XI came out in future years. But Dragon Quest VIII was absolutely hands down the game of the year for 2005. Okay, well, that's it. That's all that I have time for now. Next time we pick up a retroactive game of the year, we'll start from 2006. And there's definitely some big hitters that are coming up. But with that in mind, please do let me know if what you think of my selections here, what the game of the year winners. Do you agree with me, or do you think I'm off the, you know, I'm missing it here? Would you have picked something different? Did I not nominate something that you think would have been a better nominee? Did I make a mistake? You let me know. You can reach out to me via email at redroostersgamingcoop@gmail.com. And of course, you can now also follow me on X/Twitter. And my tag is at redroostergc. And please follow me on X, and feel free to tweet at me or to direct message me or whatever, right? So we can have a conversation. I'd love to hear from you either way. But yeah, that's everything. So thank you so much for tuning in today, and have yourself a great day. Bye-bye.